Good day, and welcome to the Immunic Therapeutics conference call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jessica Breu, Head of Investor Relations. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Eileen. Also from my side, good morning and welcome to Immunic's conference call and webcast. My name is Jessica Breu, and I'm the Head of Investor Relations and Communications at Immunic. Speaking on today's call together with me are Dr. Daniel Vitt, our Chief Executive Officer and President, and Dr. Andreas Müller, our Chief Medical Officer. The purpose of today's call is twofold. We will discuss both the data from the main phase II analysis of our CALVID-1 trial of IMU-838 in hospitalized patients with moderate COVID-19, which was published in the press release disseminated yesterday, as well as data from our investigator-sponsored phase II clinical trial of IMU-838 in primary sclerosing cholangitis, conducted in collaboration with investigators at Mayo Clinic, which was published today. After today's presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask questions on both data sets. In case we run out of time, we are more than happy to answer any further questions one-on-one after the conference call. Before we begin, as always, I would like to remind you that this presentation may contain forward-looking statements. Such statements can be identified by words such as may, will, expect, anticipate, estimate, or words with a similar meaning. Such statements involve a number of risks and uncertainties that could cause Immunic's actual results to differ materially from those discussed here. Please note that these forward-looking statements reflect Immunic's opinions only as of the date of this presentation, and it undertakes no obligation to revise or publicly release the result of any revision to these forward-looking statements in light of new information or future events. Please refer to Immunic's SEC filings for a more detailed description of the risk factors that may affect Immunic's results and these forward-looking statements. I would now like to turn the call over to Dr. Daniel Vitt.
Yeah, thank you, Jessica, and also a warm welcome to everybody on the call today from my side. It's an important and unique day for Immunic. We're very excited by positive data from two of our phase II programs, and we would like to share some more data regarding both of the trials on today's call. As Jessica said, yesterday we reported very good data from our CALVID-1 phase II trial in patients with COVID-19, where we have seen several clinically meaningful improvements across important endpoints. On top of clear efficacy signals, specifically in elderly and high-risk patients, we found a robust anti-inflammatory effect and a reduction of virus titers in the treated patients. This morning, we also announced positive data from a clinical phase II trial performed by our collaboration partner, Mayo Clinic, in patients with primary sclerosing cholangitis. Besides the statistically significant reduction in ALP levels in the patients treated per protocol, we've seen encouraging data in the ulcerative colitis UCC score in the subset of evaluated patients, the PSC-IBD. The data we present today is also relevant for other development programs. The antiviral activity against SARS-CoV-2 also underlines the broad-spectrum antiviral activity of IMU-838, which is also very relevant for our further phase III development in multiple sclerosis, which we are currently preparing based on the very positive clinical phase II data we obtained in the last summer. In parallel, we are also progressing with our phase II clinical study in ulcerative colitis, where we expect data during the first half of next year. Not to forget, we have two more clinical development programs ongoing, IMU-935 as an oral IL-17 inhibitor targeting 1-MHz, and IMU-856, which is targeting the restoration of the intestinal barrier function using a completely new molecular mode of action. But let us dig into the COVID-19 data in more detail. We started our work on fighting the pandemic starting from the established broad-spectrum antiviral activity of IMU-838. This was shown for several RNA and DNA viruses in independent experiments and recently published. IMU-828 has the advantage of targeting a host cell-based approach and therefore is expected to be efficacious on very different mutant forms of SARS-CoV-2 as well. The molecule is preventing the supply of the infected cell with sufficient building blocks for RNA and therefore leading to stop of production of viral RNA proteins. Related experiments in vitro are currently ongoing or initiated. But let us focus on the clinical data today. With this, I'm happy to hand over to Andreas Müller, our Chief Medical Officer at Immunic. Andreas, please go ahead.
Yes, good morning, everybody. So Andreas Müller, I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Immunic, and I will guide you through the clinical data here for these two programs that we're presenting today. So first, I will start with the COVID-19 trial, the CALVID trial, that we reported the results yesterday. This slide summarizes the general study design. The study randomized patients into two treatment arms, 45 milligrams IMU-838 and placebo, and the treatment period was 14 days. It should be noted that standard of care treatments according to local standard, including drugs that were approved under EUA mechanism or similar mechanisms in these countries, were allowed in this trial for both treatment arms. Patient enrolled were hospitalized patients with moderate disease, which means either WHO score 3, which are basically patients that are hospitalized but without requirement for supplemental oxygen, or WHO score 4, which are patients that are receiving supplemental oxygen but they're not on ventilation, not on non-invasive or invasive ventilation. Let's come to the baseline characteristics of the patients that we had included in this trial. So patients altogether came from 20 active sites in the US and Europe into this trial. This main analysis that we have reported yesterday reports on 204 patients, of which 202 patients received any study drug. Of these 202 patients, 99 patients were dosed with IMU-838, and 103 patients had received placebo. This full analysis set therefore includes 202 patients. However, for some endpoints, certain patients had to be excluded, which is then labeled as a modified full analysis set. I just want to alert you to that here. We will report the full data on the complete data set of this trial, which includes 223 randomized patients in the second quarter of this year. However, this main analysis was really set up to provide the main top-line data that Immunic required to make a decision on the further development of IMU-838 in COVID patients. So this slide summarizes the risk factors and some of the baseline values for disease markers in this trial. It should be noted that some of these risk factors were more present in the IMU-838 arm, such as, for example, the pre-existing cardiovascular disease or higher levels of CRP or D-dimer. This suggests the population in the IMU-838 treatment arm with a more severe disease course. So this study is somewhat unbalanced, favoring placebo here. So please keep this in mind when you see the data. This slide now summarizes some of the important concomitant therapies that were given as part of the standard of care in this trial. As expected, about two-thirds of patients received corticosteroids, and also the combination with direct antiviral drugs was allowed, and this happened in about 20% of patients. So now, of course, let's come to the efficacy part, which is probably the most interesting part for you. We need to remember, this slide is about the primary endpoint, and we need to remember that 11 months ago when we designed this trial, the medical resource shortage was really the topic number one in this pandemic. The primary endpoint was discussed with regulatory agencies and also with clinical experts, and they all suggested to focus this trial on preventing severe complications of COVID disease, such as the need for invasive ventilation. Data also at this time had shown relatively high rates for invasive ventilation, and unfortunately, this has changed since then due to better patient handling, better treatment, and also standard of care procedures. This trial has shown that in this moderate patient population of COVID-19, the rate of invasive ventilation now is below 1%. For that reason, the primary endpoint cannot be evaluated. So this slide is about key secondary endpoints, which I think has a similar pattern. Regulators in interaction with Immunic put a lot of emphasis at that time on mortality endpoints. However, we feel that this probably did not recognize enough that this is a non-severe patient population of COVID-19 patients. In this trial, we found a 28-day mortality that was below 2%, and the ICU use was below 4.5% in this trial. These heart endpoints can, for that reason, also not be evaluated in this trial. This is not entirely unexpected from the changes in the disease outcome that were seen over the last 11 months. So this slide now goes into the data, or starts to go into the data, and summarizes the proportion of patients with clinical recovery on days 14 and 28. Clinical recovery is defined when the main symptoms of COVID-19 disease have cleared. The data show a numerical advantage in favor of IMU-833 treatment. This slide summarizes the time in days that patients require to achieve clinical improvement, which is defined as the improvement of WHO scores by at least 2 points or life hospital discharge, whatever came first. The study design included some biases for data evaluation of this endpoint in the 14-day treatment period of the study, which are more in detail explained in the press release and also in the full slide deck. There is a clear numerical advantage of faster clinical improvement in favor of IMU-838. I need to stress that these are the data for all the patient population combined in this trial. So it's a general patient population. So this slide goes into the high-risk and elderly populations. Very interestingly, if you look just at the time of, this slide summarizes the time and days that patients require to achieve clinical improvement for patients with high risk factors and the elderly population. Very interestingly, if you look at the time of clinical improvement in IMU-838 treated patients in these three patient populations, the data seem very similar. It seems that IMU-838 seems to level the playing field, and the treatment with IMU-838 seems to allow high-risk and elderly patients to reach clinical improvement in the same time period as the general patient population. However, the high-risk and elderly patients require considerably longer time to clinical improvement when treated with the current standard of care and supplemented with placebo here. As you can see, the numerical advantages of IMU-838 versus placebo become more pronounced when only those high-risk patients or elderly patients are considered. Immunic believes that these data provide a clinically meaningful result and a potential for positioning of IMU-838 in the treatment of non-severe COVID-19 patients. This slide summarizes the same time to clinical improvement endpoint when patients are separated into those that are treated early or later in the disease. As seen with other antiviral drugs, IMU-838 is more effective when used early in the disease. That means in this case, within the first 8 days after the onset of the symptoms. This next slide summarizes the proportion of patients with clinical improvement at two different time points. While eventually almost all of the patients with moderate COVID disease achieve clinical improvement within a month, IMU-838 increases the proportion of those patients at earlier time points. So these were the data for the general trial population. The next slide shows the same endpoint, the proportion of patient clinical improvement, for the group of elderly patients. While again, almost all of the patients eventually achieve clinical improvement in a month, even for the high-risk patients. However, the 838 treatment further increased the difference of patients versus placebo that achieve this clinical improvement at earlier time points. Again, it should be noted that IMU-838 achieves basically the same proportion of patients with clinical improvement at day 14 for the elderly population as for the general trial population, seemingly equalizing their risk profile for disease improvements. This next slide compares the data for clinical improvement for patients that receive treatment with IMU-838 alone versus combination treatment of IMU-838 with any direct antiviral therapy which was allowed in this trial. As can be seen, monotherapy with IMU-838 was as effective as combination with direct antivirals. Now we're coming to our currently available virology data and to data of the biochemical disease markers. IMU-838 is a DHODH inhibitor which was shown to have broad in vitro antiviral activity for multiple virus families, as Daniel showed you earlier here in the presentation. And data suggest that this is due to pyrimidin starving in the virus-infected human host cells, thereby preventing virus replication in these host cells. We are happy to report that this antiviral effect of IMU-838 can be confirmed in this trial based on the changes of viral loads as compared to baseline. This next slide summarizes the data for CRP, C-reactive protein, which is a systemic inflammation marker that is also strongly associated with clinical outcomes in COVID-19 patients. IMU-838 also selectively inhibits strongly metabolically activated immune cells to dampen the overshooting immune response in COVID-19 disease, while not having general immunosuppressive or anti-proliferative effects. This selective anti-inflammatory effect of IMU-838 can be seen quite early in therapy as a difference in the evolution of CRP values between IMU-838 and placebo-treated patients here. This slide then shows the data on the disease marker D-dimer. Early in the pandemic situation, it became clear that the SARS-CoV-2 virus activates complement, and thus D-dimer as a peptide that results from complement activation can be used as a disease marker strongly associated with patient outcomes and disease severity. As can be seen here on this slide, IMU-838 leads to a much faster decline in D-dimer than standard of care treatment with placebo. So this is probably my personal favorite slide here. These are our data on long COVID symptoms, in particular for the main long COVID symptoms, fatigue. This is known now and has been widely recognized as the one remaining long-term symptoms of COVID patients, including many young patients, that prevents them from fully participating in social and work life after full recovery from the acute virus infection. I have to point out that this is a post hoc analysis. When the investigators were still blinded, we had sent questionnaires to three high enrolling sites in this trial and asked to list for each patient at their site the remaining long COVID symptoms at the time when the patient completed this trial. We received back 36 completed questionnaires, of which 27 patients are actually part of this main analysis that we present here. Although the patient's numbers are small, we're only reporting here on 27 patients, we believe it's an intriguing finding that 80% of the placebo patients presented with the long COVID symptoms of fatigue, but only 50% of patients treated with IMU-838 did so. Since this is an unaddressed area of the COVID disease right now, and there's a great medical need, Immunic believes that these are interesting initial data that require further evaluation. So in summary for efficacy, I have presented to you that primary and key secondary endpoints could not be evaluated as the inherent rate of these serious complications are too low in this moderate COVID population. However, Immunic believes that the secondary endpoints, including time to recovery, clinical improvement, as well as viral load and disease marker, all show a consistent favorable effect of IMU-838 treatment versus placebo. High-risk and elderly patients seem to benefit even more from IMU-838 treatment, and their risk profile seem to equalize with the general patient population using IMU-838 treatment. This study indicates that IMU-838 may be a convenient oral treatment option for patients with moderate COVID-19. We also believe that these efficacy data advantages of treatment versus placebo are in the same range as other medications that have been tested in COVID-19 patients, have been successfully tested in COVID-19 patients. Since such other drugs are mostly injectables and often have been tested, including a more severe patient population, we believe that IMU-838 as an oral treatment option, having shown numerical advantages, multiple clinical and biochemical endpoints, potentially provides a unique clinical positioning. We hope that this will be recognized by regulators as well. So let's switch then to the safety results of the COVID-19 trial. The general safety and tolerance profile of IMU-838 in this patient population of moderate COVID patients has been unremarkable. This confirms the favorable safety profile of IMU-838 from other patient populations. I would like to point out that our full slide presentation made publicly available this morning and yesterday morning contains a lot more granular safety data than I will present here. What I would like to present here is the group of treatment emergent adverse events in this trial that had an increased severity, at least of grade 2, and were related to COVID-19. As can be seen here on the slide, severe COVID-related adverse events had a lower presence in IMU-838 treated patients than in placebo-treated patients. Although this is a safety analysis, this also seems to point to an efficacy effect of IMU-838 as well here. In summary, the trial was shown that IMU-838 is a safe treatment option in moderate COVID-19 patients. And we also believe that this provides a unique benefit-risk ratio and may be able to expand the universe of treated COVID patients that can be addressed. So this summarizes the clinical data, and I will give back to Daniel for a sum up of this part of the presentation.
Thank you, Andreas, for showing us all this exciting data. So to summarize, IMU-838 showed evidence of clinical activity on multiple clinical endpoints in hospitalized patients with moderate COVID-19. The treatment effect of 838 compares nicely with that of other medications successfully tested in COVID-19, with highly relevant anti-inflammatory and antiviral activity demonstrated. Firstly, I'm impressed by the effect on preventing long COVID symptoms, which suggests that IMU-838 could be a promising new therapeutic intervention for this condition and it's yet unmet need. As a next step, Immunic will discuss this results with clinical and regulatory experts, and we're also planning to meet with regulatory authorities how we can use the obtained data for an accelerated use of IMU-838 to treat COVID-19 as disease. In parallel, we are also exploring options for further development and for additional funding support of further trials. Okay, so but today there's one more thing. This morning we also published clinical data obtained from an investigator-sponsored phase 2 clinical trial in patients with primary sclerosing cholangitis. This clinical trial was performed by Mayo Clinic with financial support from the NIH. We provided the study medication for this trial. We'll show you some clinical outcome data today. However, as per agreement between Immunic and Mayo Clinic, Immunic only gets access to limited top-line efficacy and safety data so far. Additional and more complete data will be accessible by Immunic only at a later time point, and Immunic is subject to certain restrictions regarding data publication before the full data is published by Mayo Clinic. And with this, I want to hand over once again to Andreas to dig into more clinical data coming out of this data evaluation.
Thank you, Daniel. I would like to quickly introduce the setting of this clinical trial here that we're reporting. This was an investigator clinical trial supported by an NIH grant and was performed under an investigator IND at two sites of Mayo Clinic in Arizona and Minnesota. We would really like to acknowledge the efforts by these investigators, thankful for the very close collaborations we had with Mayo Clinic. The study was supported by Munich by providing study drug. The dose of 30 milligrams IMU-838 was used in this trial. And this is a relatively low dose, but it was chosen by Munich as we did not have any pharmacokinetic data in hepatic impaired patients yet. And this is a consideration, this is an important consideration in the patient population of progressive liver disease, consistently leading to liver failure in the end stages of the disease. Immunic intended this to be a proof of concept study in an orphan liver disease where no medication is currently available, and liver transplantation is often the only remaining treatment option for these patients, and thus a large unmet medical need exists to find effective therapy. Immunic also believes that potentially this could provide an opportunity for an accelerated drug approval, given more extensive clinical trials need to be done than in this exploratory study. Once again, a reminder that this is an open-label study, and the duration of treatment was set to 6 months, consistent with other feasibility trials in this patient population. The primary endpoint here was a biochemical liver marker, a 25% decrease in alkaline phosphatase, we abbreviated here with ALP in the presentation, at week 24, while other liver markers were not allowed to increase by more than 33% from baseline at the same time. The study had been planned to include 30 patients in total. Enrollment started in July 2019, and despite this being a rare liver disease, a total of 27 PSC patients were able to be screened, and 18 patients were finally included in this trial until early 2020. These 18 patients are the ITT, the intent to treat population, this trial. The COVID pandemic disrupted this trial. These patients are considered high risk for viral infections due to their disease. Due to the disease rarity, patients also traveling long distances or travel by air to these tertiary care centers like Mayo Clinic. This became increasingly difficult in a pandemic situation, and the principal investigator could no longer enroll patients at that situation. In addition, patients already enrolled in this trial were unable to come to study visits, and 7 out of these 18 enrolled patients eventually discontinued for different reasons, but also including withdrawing due to the pandemic situation. For this reason, only 11 of the 18 patients received a full 24-week treatment course of IMU-838 and completed the required assessments for the primary endpoint. We believe that the analysis of the efficacy data should therefore focus on these 11 patients that comprise the per protocol or PP population here in this trial. This is quite unfortunate, but the principal investigator felt it was impossible to wait for a change in the pandemic situation to allow for more time to include more patients. So this next slide summarizes the demographics and the baseline characteristics of the enrolled patients. I would like to focus here on the fact that PSC, progressive sclerosing cholangitis, is a disease where many patients also suffer from IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, such as ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And IBD was present in 12 out of these 18 enrolled patients. So let's start initially with the data that we currently have regarding the efficacy of IMU-838 in this PSC population. This slide summarizes the results for the primary endpoint of this study. We are quite pleased to present you these data. In summary, 3 out of 11 patients in the per protocol population reached the primary endpoint of the study, showing a minimum of 25% decrease of alkaline phosphatase at week 24. Despite the low patient number in this trial, we believe that this provides an initial efficacy signal of IMU-838 treatment in this progressive liver disease. We really need to put this into perspective, what we have seen here for the this 20% percent of patients having a decrease in alkaline phosphatase into perspective to other trials that have been done in this indication and have been used at very similar endpoint and treatment periods. Cilofexor and FXR agonist, now in phase 3 trials in PSC patients, has shown that a low dose of this drug was able to observe a 25% reduction of ALP in 5% of the patients, and the high dose of cilofexor showed this 25% reduction of ALP in 30% of patients. We believe that this puts the value of the 27% of patients reaching this endpoint using 30 milligrams of IMU-838, a relatively low dose, into perspective. The patient number in this trial is unfortunately limited, but the data show a comparable proportion of patients reaching these established bioclinical endpoint here in PSC patients. This slide summarizes the evaluation of alkaline phosphatase as a continuous quantitative biochemical marker. The results show that treatment using 30 milligram of IMU-838 in only the 11 per protocol patients provides a statistically significant decrease in alkaline phosphate with a p-value of 0.041 and a 95% confidence interval that does not include the no change scenario, even in these 11 patients. Although the magnitude of the ALP change per 30 days may be modest, this is a progressive disease where ALP values are known to generally increase over the disease period. And for that reason, I think we also would like to show you these individual ALP changes for the 11 patients in the per protocols population. And this slide provides the change of these ALP values between baseline and week 24, which is the end of the treatment, and then the change of ALP after cessation of treatment until week 28 as a follow-up time point. What we would like to point out in this slide is the very consistent decrease or stable behavior of ALP in these 11 IMU-838 treated patients. There was not a single patient in the per protocol population that showed an increase in ALP during the treatment period, which is usually defined as a 20% increase versus baseline. There are also two patients where alkaline phosphatase values sharply increased when IMU-838 treatment was stopped. So this slide is intended to show the usual pattern of changes in alkaline phosphatase in this disease and in other drug trials, using the example of a vedolizumab trial in PSC patients. This should put into perspective the very consistent pattern of stable or decreasing alkaline phosphatase in the 11 IMU-838 treated patients of the per protocol population. In this trial of vedolizumab, alkaline phosphatase decreased in about 20% of patients, was stable in 40% of patients, and increased in another 40% of patients. This is approximately the expected pattern of ALP change over time in a PSC population. Immunic believes that the very consistent pattern of stable and decreasing ALP values seen with IMU-838 without any patients where ALP increased by more than 20% makes it much more likely that the data in the IMU-838 trial present a true treatment effect rather than just a statistical phenomenon in a small patient group. We also very quickly would like to show you the data in the subset of patients that had inflammatory bowel disease as part of their PSC disease. So in this trial, we had patients that had a comorbidity of IBD and PSC. And that's quite common, actually, in PSC. As Immunic is currently, of course, in the advanced stages of a phase 2 trial in UC patients, this was of great interest to us. While there are some known differences between PSC IBD and IBD, there's generally quite a large overlap in these diseases. This study included a physician-evaluated IBD score, as well as the patient-reported outcome related to gut and general health quality of life in these patients. This slide summarizes the data in the physician-evaluated endpoint of ulcerative colitis clinical score, which is a simplification of the more widely used Mayo score used in ulcerative colitis. This includes evaluation of gut symptoms as well as the patient and physician global assessment. Higher scores usually mean higher disease activity. Although the patient numbers are relatively small in this open-label trial, these data seem to indicate that at least there were no exacerbations of disease activity observed during the roughly half a year of treatment with IMU-838, and the data actually indicate ongoing remission in these patients. The next slide shows the data in the patient-reported outcome of the short inflammatory bowel disease questionnaires. The patients evaluated the health-related quality of life for different domains. Higher values here indicate a better quality of life. Again here, a small patient number, but consistent with the physician score, the quality of life in these PCIBD patients looks stable or better during the IMU-838 treatment. Immunic believes that the value of both IBD-related endpoints is certainly limited due to the low patient numbers, but are very encouraging. But we also need to remember that it's an open-label trial. So quickly to the safety results here in the PEACE trial that are currently available to us. This is a short summary of adverse events in this trial, which were generally mild and fall within the expected range of side effects in a PEC patient population. As this is an open-label trial, no comparative statements versus comparator arm can be made. Immunic feels that there has been no safety signal in this trial with unexpected AEs or any increase of severity of AEs. No serious adverse events were also observed in this trial. So with this short summary of the clinical data, I will give back to Daniel for some outlook in this indication.
Yeah, thank you, Andreas, for sharing this nice data with us. And I hope you all can feel our excitement about two positive readouts from different trials. But let's look a little bit on the outlook for PSC as indication. But first of all, the encouraging results regarding biochemical parameters and safety suggest that A2H merits further clinical testing in PSC. And in discussion with investigators and clinical experts to further evaluate the data set and to explore potential next steps, we believe that dose optimization would be needed for potential future trials, which would also require assessment of pharmacokinetics in hepatic impaired patients, for example. With this, I would like to conclude the presentation and hand over to the operator for the Q&A session.
We will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touchtone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Our first question today comes from Yasmeen Rahimi with Piper Sandler.
Hi, team. Congrats on the updates, and thank you so much for the very comprehensive presentation across COVID and PSC. I have three separate questions for you. One is in regards to the COVID program. What would be really helpful for us is if you could walk us through what are the next steps and what type of factors goes into your decision, whether you wanted to develop this into phase three, move it to a phase three program. And then in regards to PSC, we noticed that many of the biochemical controls were actually not changed. And I understand that those were not getting worse on 838, but how important is biochemical control of ALT, AST, and many of the other parameters? And then lastly, did you see any improvements on HN fatigue, which end up being very big disease burden to the PSC population? And thank you so much for taking our questions.
Maybe thank you, Yas, for the question. And maybe I can start a little bit with our thoughts regarding the way forward for COVID-19. I think maybe to just summarize where we stand. So we just got that data. I think it's really a good set of data, specifically considering that all the signals we've seen here go into the right direction, just a reminder, the anti-inflammatory effects, very quick onset here, antiviral activity, but also the clinical benefits, which maybe are more pronounced in the elderly population. And what we think is the first thing we will do now is to speak with regulatory authorities and to see if what is the way forward here with the data we have now. In parallel, we are thinking about several potential designs of further trials. However, this would really require first the discussions with the regulators. So that's definitely the next step here. And also, as we said in the presentation, we are in discussions to also secure further financing to really potentially accelerate any further activities in clinical trials.
So before we ask you, I'll take over the remaining two questions, and I wrote them down this time because I think I often forget these. So very good. Thank you, for these good questions. So in PSC, I think there is a little bit of difference between alkaline phosphatase and the remaining disease marker, the remaining liver markers there. Usually alkaline phosphatase is really tied to disease activity, and that's why we're looking at ALP as the marker that is usually used as the biochemical marker that correlates with disease activity in PSC. The remaining markers have prognostic value. So because the ALT, AST, and especially bilirubin really have tell you whether a patient goes into liver failure. And that's why I think the endpoint that was basically suggested by the principal investigator in this trial was to combine those two so that you have a decrease in ALP, which basically indicates a lower disease activity, whereas the other liver markers like ALT, for example, could not be increasing at the same time, which would be actually pointing to that this patient goes into liver failure. So I think combining these two in an endpoint was the right thing to do, which is, I think, a little bit different to, for example, cilofexor, where the primary endpoint in this phase two trial was only the 25% decrease in ALP. But we felt that I think it has to be combined here together with the investigator. We decided to do this. Especially bilirubin has been known to be a prognostic factor that really points to general deterioration of this patient down the road. And here we saw in this trial really no change in bilirubin. It was very stable over the all of the trial period, although this is only 6 months. And we are quite happy about this data. The last question that you had was about fatigue. Unfortunately, this trial in PSC patients did not measure fatigue. We had no specific fatigue score. The health-related quality of life score in these PSC IBD patients includes statements that I think could include any fatigue contribution, but there was no specific fatigue score that we had or a questionnaire that we had done in the study. So unfortunately, that's not available.
Thank you, Andreas. Maybe just comment on, did you see improvements in itch in these patients?
In what? I'm sorry, I missed that.
In itch, in pruritus?
We did not measure pruritus or any other known side effects that we have from drugs like Urso, I think, in this patient population. And also the AE profile does not include, this is not a prominent AE here for this drug and has not been seen in this patient population.
Thank you. Thank you for that, answering my question.
Thank you, yes.
And our next question comes from Thomas Smith with SVB Leerink.
Hey guys, good morning. Thanks for taking the questions and congrats on the progress. Maybe first, just on the COVID program, can you talk about how you're thinking about the potential in the long COVID population? You highlighted the signal you saw in this study on patients' fatigue scores, but are there any other parameters that you think are key where you think 838 would have an impact? And when do you think you'll be in a position to provide an update on what the clinical path forward would look like here?
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for the question. And as you said, it's an exciting observation here, even if it was only in the subgroup where we really measured the long COVID thing. It looks like there is an interesting impact here. We are exploring, I think this data is really new. We need some time to really talk to experts. I think maybe, Andreas, you can comment on the feedback we got from investigators on the long COVID question.
So first of all, Tom, thank you for the question. And there are other long COVID symptoms that have been reported, consistent, I think, with what you know from the literature and what is reported for other COVID long COVID symptoms. These are usually single cases of other COVID symptoms, long COVID symptoms, heart disease, brain fogging, and so forth. And so it's difficult or impossible to really make an assessment for other than fatigue, because fatigue is so prevalent as a long COVID symptoms, long COVID symptoms in these patients. It's an interesting discussion because we actually talked to clinical experts and showed them the long COVID data, and they were extremely excited because there's really a large patient population that they have to deal with, where the acute infection is over, and they don't know what to do with these patients other than wait and give symptomatic treatment, and some of these fatigue cases really take a long time to clear, several months to clear, and it really inhibits their social and work activities for these patients. And in particular, these are often young patients where they want to go back to their work life, to their social life, and they're really impossible to do so. So one of the investigators actually mentioned that if she just posts this on social media for in the chat groups that she's part of, she would have 200 patients lining up the next morning. But I think what we need to do is really look at or speak with regulators, how they feel about a long COVID as a way forward, and whether that's a indication for them that they would accept for a regulatory filing, for example, for approval, or at least as part of the regulatory filing, if they would consider this relevant enough to allow for this indication. I think our experience with regulators throughout the last 11 months was that they have been very much focused on a severe patient group, which is understandable, and on very hard endpoints like mortality, which to my mind is not necessarily relevant for this drug as we look at the non-severe patient population. IMU-838 is an oral drug, very conveniently given to patients, has a very favorable safety profile. So we really don't think that, we believe that IMU-838 could expand the treatment paradigm for non-severe patients. So I think this is probably a discussion with regulators, how open they are for other endpoints than mortality. And we have seen this now for the Lilly approval about 10 days ago, where the regulators were open to basically taking these secondary clinical endpoints, and they also were open to giving approval for high-risk patient populations or elderly populations, I think, which is quite encouraging to us. But I think, given our experience with regulators for COVID-19, we would like to test the waters a little bit more, what's our way forward, because we believe that most likely we would be focusing on a subset of patients where this has the most value, IMU-838, so either in high-risk patients or elderly patients, or in long for the treatment of long COVID. But it's the regulatory uncertainty, unfortunately, is relatively high, and that's why we think we need to address this before we can really give an update on what we do going forward. I hope this clarifies a little bit, Tom. what our thinking is.
Got it. No, thanks very much for the insights. And then maybe just a quick follow-up on TSC. Were the patients in this study permitted to be on concomitant URSO? And I guess if so, do you have a sense of ALK-FOS response by background URSO use?
No, this was monotherapy. They were not allowed to have any other therapies in the treatment period. So sorry, I did not mention this in the presentation.
Okay. And then do you have a sense for patients who may have been previously exposed to URSO or previously, you know, treatment experience with URSO? Do you have a sense of how those patients may have responded?
So I don't have the data, and that's why I think we put a little disclaimer in. There's a lot of more information that we would like to have, but since it's an investigator trial, in our agreement with Mayo Clinic, basically states that we only get top-line data until they have published from their side these data. They want to prevent that. We're pre-publishing too much of these informations before they're able to publish it. And that's why a lot of these more detailed questions that would be also of interest to me, for example, what their previous response has been to other drugs, I think is not available to us at this time. Sorry for that.
Okay, understood. No, thanks for taking the questions, guys. Appreciate the insights.
Our next question comes from Zegba Jala with Roth Capital.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for the detailed presentation. Actually have a couple of different questions. So starting with the COVID data, very interesting to kind of see that you saw antiviral and anti-inflammatory effects despite patients being on antivirals and corticosteroids, systemic corticosteroids. So I was just kind of curious. I know you said 20% of antivirals. Did you kind of look at the response or the antiviral response of patients that were already in antivirals and then patients that were just on IMU-838 or the same thing for the corticosteroids? Just kind of wondering, you know, how impactful your antiviral and anti-inflammatory effects were. And then also in COVID, just kind of also curious if you will move forward with a phase 3 if you're not granted EUA, although I think it's, you know, really interesting that you might be able to, considering that this is an older drug, and at some point we're going to have to try to address patients that are not as severe as they were before.
So
maybe I start first.
Okay.
May I start with the second question and give you time for the first one? I think our report, one thing is really important, and it's a consistent message of the company. Our priority is really on continuing in preparation and execution of the phase 3 trial in multiple sclerosis. And this is our highest priority for the company. And in parallel, I think we do everything to really use this data we have to make it, the drug available to patients and give us some time to explore the options with regulators and also with other supporters to make sure we do the best out of that. There are subgroups, there's this inflammatory data, the antiviral data. There's a lot we can do, long COVID, but also the WHO stage 3 and 4 patients. So there's a lot we can do. We will do our very best to progress that, but we will definitely not harm our capabilities to progress on the MS phase 3 preparation and execution. And with that, I would like to hand over to Andreas.
Yeah. So hi, Zachary. Thanks for the good questions. The only data we have so far is the, and we were able to do, is basically the slide that I showed you here, where we looked at patients who received the direct antivirals, the 20% of patients that direct antivirals, versus those patients that did not receive antivirals in combination with IMU-838, and the data look very comparable, so that there's no difference. We have not looked we have no data on a subpopulation of patients who received corticosteroids and not received corticosteroids and so forth. So unfortunately, I'm unable to address this. And it's interesting, and this is an ongoing analysis, of course, of these subgroups. And we'll also have the final analysis later this year in second quarter with all of the patients. That includes a lot more efficacy readouts, especially these subgroup or subpopulation analyses, that we haven't available yet, because we really focused on, in this main analysis, on having data that will allow us to go to regulators and to make decisions about the further development. So unfortunately, not yet available, sorry.
Thanks, Andreas. And then regarding the PSC data, I just had a couple questions. You know, from a baseline perspective, how severe were these patients? And then can you also put into perspective that 25% reduction in ALP? You know, what does that mean in terms of reducing the risk for a liver transplant? And then the other one is, I think when we spoke about this earlier, there's a thought that you could, you know, finish up this study and then transition to a pivotal PSC study. Since you have less patients than you had intended, we're just wondering, you know, is that transition still possible? And if you were to do so, you know, how long would it take? Because I think you know that the potential to also explore the use of a higher dose. And then lastly, just another question about the phase three, you know, try to accelerate things. Are you going to just look at patients with concomitant IBD, or are you just going to look at all comers? And then Daniel, just because you mentioned it, you know, focus still remains on the MS program. So can you provide any update on, you know, steps that you're taking now to, you know, make sure the phase three study is initiated?
I'll let Daniel start.
No, I think maybe most of the questions are for you, Andreas. I think just on the way forward for PSC, I think, as you said, Zachary, and it's a very good and important question. So what is the intelligent way forward here? I think the first question which comes up, can we increase the dosing? Because we didn't start with the highest dose we could do. We were quite cautious on that end. And therefore, as I said, PK assessment in liver-impaired patient would be a prerequisite to dosing higher. And then any way forward would somehow require dose finding in this indication. This could be part of a pivotal program. That's something which is maybe something we can only really precisely discuss once we have the PK in liver-impaired patients. So I think it would be a stepwise approach forward. And also, I think on the risk-benefit profile, a quite wise way forward for PSC, which could really offer a new therapeutic to the patients without really risking too much in the next step of development. But maybe, Andreas, back to the baseline questions, maybe more on your end.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I'll hope that way I can address all of these questions. So first question was, how far along in the disease course were these patients that were included? Since we had no data in hepatic impairment, we excluded some of the later stages and higher liver impairment scores here in this patient population. So in general, I think this was a more early is probably the wrong word, but less liver impaired patients here in this trial. These were not end stage liver patients that are, you know, just a few months away from liver transplantation. So this, we require that they had an increase in ALP, I think about 0.5 at least of upper limit normal. So we required an increase, but I think in general these were the earlier stages of the disease. The question of higher dose, I think, is important. I think, and that was clearly seen from the Cilofexor data, that a higher dose can make a significantly higher impact on the efficacy values here. And I think that we believe that's quite important to really optimize the dose. And optimize the dose really means that we adapt the dose to the highest possible levels to avoid accumulation of the drug that could be affecting the safety. And this is something that can be easily and also relatively quickly addressed in a hepatic impairment study. And we believe that's really the next steps if we want to go forward with this indication, which we, I think, believe these are very strong data and we should explore this further. In terms of going straight to a phase three program, I think it depends a little bit, of course, on the risk appetite of a biotech company, whether to do this. And I think for all of the previous developments that we had done as a company and as a management team, we always felt that we should make smart decisions and try to manage our risk going forward, which probably would mean here that we'll probably have a more adaptive approach where we probably would like to get more data to expand really beyond these 11 patients and then maybe have also an adaptive program where we can go from a phase two kind of setting in a higher dose, optimized dose, into a phase three setting. But this is still under discussion how this is possible. The regulators would have to play a large role. But I think the clinical expert that we've talked to, I think, have been quite encouraging to say that this should be explored further. These hepatologists also that we spoke to, I think they recognize that there is an absolutely high need of having companies going in and really exploring this indication as there's really a dire need for new therapies in this indication for these patients. In principle, I would say that my current thinking would be to really have all comers and not focus on PSC-IBD patients that have both diseases. I think that would limit us unnecessarily. And we presented these IBD data here because we believe it can give some guidance on expectations on the phase two UC trial that's currently ongoing and that are in the advanced stages may help us to understand a little bit what to expect from this trial. But other than that, I think we will focus on a general, in quotes, PSC population for any future trials, like in this trial.
Someone missed the MS question. Sorry.
Thanks, guys.
Our next question comes from Liana Musatos with Wedbush.
Thank you for taking my question. It's about PSC. I remember in the past that regulators had said that ALP alone wasn't enough for approval. Have they decided that combining it with AST, ALT, bilirubin would be enough? I noticed your PI wanted those endpoints. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think these biochemical endpoints are really used for these phase two type proof of concept exploratory dose finding trials and pivotal trials. I think the guidance that we also have seen from the FDA here on the investigator IND was that other endpoints would be required and also longer follow-up than 6 months, longer treatment period and longer evaluation period, longer than 6 months would be required. So I think this is a good endpoint that correlates really with disease activity for these proof of concept trials, but regulators would like to see other endpoints for the pivotal trials. This will include PSC and will include these biochemical markers, but it will be supplemented by imaging and potentially also biopsy.
Okay, so what is the requirement then for approval in phase three?
So I'm not the regulator to have there's no guidance document, of course, in PSC, but okay. I think what you have seen in the past and what we have seen from the interaction is that they would like to have imaging added here to this to these biochemical markers, which mainly goes to the evaluation of liver stiffness and also potentially a biopsy. But I think the imaging markers of liver stiffness is, I think, the most important thing for regulators.
Thank you very much.
And our next question will come from Matt Catlin with Ladenburg Thalmann.
Hi, good morning. Congrats on the progress. Wanted to dig into the COVID-19 trials a little bit more. You saw very interesting and dramatic impact on CRP and viral load. Could you talk about the duration of dosing that you used in the PSC trial, and would it be, I guess, in the COVID-19 trial, and would it be interesting to dose patients for a longer period of time rather than just the 14 days, I guess, going forward, given the safety profile that you've observed?
Hi, Matt. Good morning. Yeah, very good questions. And I think, of course, we didn't have a lot of time to explore different dosing regimens here for the COVID-19 trial, given the pandemic situation. This was our best guess based on the treatment period of other drugs, the treatment period usually for other antiviral drugs, how they influence when they show an antiviral effect. I think in general, I would say, I think the dosing for 14 days here, and we're doing it twice daily of 22.5 milligrams or 45 milligrams in total, but we split the dose here in this trial to achieve a very good trough levels in these patients. I think for the general COVID treatment, I think it seems like this is maybe an appropriate treatment period from what I can deduct from the data. I think where it becomes probably the right question to ask when we go into long COVID, whether there an increased treatment duration would be of help, because I think some of the hypotheses why you have these remaining long COVID symptoms, and especially the fatigue, is that you have ongoing a low-level inflammation, maybe even low-level neuroinflammation that really changes the neurotransmitter balance in the brain and so forth. And I believe, I think there, it just from the mechanistic point of view, it would be worthwhile to consider a longer treatment period. But this is all speculation on my part. But I think it's a very good question that I also thought about when we saw the long COVID data.
Yeah, Matt, maybe I can add something here. I think, first of all, thank you for this question, because this is touching an observation which was a little bit of a surprise to us as well. If you look on the slide Andreas presented on the CRP levels, looks like there was a quite immediate onset and a very strong reduction of that signal. And, of course, in the beginning we thought that one of the key hallmarks of H2AD is the antiviral activity alone, but it looks like there's more. And this, as Andrea said, this offers, and maybe this is the reason also maybe for the long COVID efficacy we have seen. So this gives at least space for improving and playing around a little bit with different dosing regimens and way forward. But this is, I think, part of the whole discussion we are having right now. What is the perfect strategy forward for the drug to really make the best use of out of the properties we have observed in this wonderful trial.
Okay, that's helpful. And then just shifting gears to PSC, given the effect that you mentioned of cilofexor in terms of them seeing an increased reduction of patients in terms of at higher doses and the efficacy there, any reason in terms of the mechanism of action for 838 that you would expect increased efficacy with higher doses as you explore those and I guess in next steps in PSC?
So in terms of the mechanism of action, Matt, I think we know that there is you have when you do the in vitro experiments on activated human lymphocytes, for example, ex vivo, that there's an IC50 and an IC90 value, and with the 30 milligram dose, we're getting close to the IC90 values, of course, that you see there. There may be other effects, and we also have to consider that there is tissue penetration to the site of inflammation, which is the bile duct here in PSC. We have to consider for these assessments of efficacy. And I think there's a reasonable expectation, I think, on our side that increased doses may help that tissue penetration onto the site of inflammation. Because here, I think not necessarily the blood is the site of activity, to my mind. As compared to MS, I think where the circulating lymphocytes are really, that's what we target with IMU-838 in blood. And that's why, maybe that's the reason why, for example, the two doses, 30 and 45 milligrams in the phase two trial, were relatively similar or when it came to efficacy in the MS trial. But I think it's a reasonable expectation, this indication, that increasing doses may increase the patients that achieve a better biochemical readout, or that more patients achieve these biochemical readouts. But that's something to be explored, of course.
Thanks, Master. Thanks a lot for taking the questions.
Okay, maybe then we can conclude the call. Thank you all for dialing in and listening to the update here on these two very, very promising, very good trials. We got data and presented more data. Just remind everybody who's interested in more details, we filed the 8-Ks with a full presentation slide deck for both trials so that everybody can dig into more detail. And we continue to be very open on the communication. And thank you to our analysts asking questions, and stay safe and healthy, and thank you and goodbye.
The conference has now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.